Stay tuned for a Juno Afternoon. Photographer and explorer Daniel Fox will be here to talk about his work. We'll talk with Charles Ward about a civil cup of coffee, and we'll find out where 800 dolls live here in Juneau. Taking a look at the weather for the rest of today, patchy fog with some rain. Tonight, cloudy with lows around 50. Tomorrow, also cloudy with highs in the mid-60s. And tomorrow night, a chance of rain with lows around 50. Looking ahead to Wednesday, also a chance of rain showers with highs around 60. Stay tuned for a Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A recent annual summer meeting of Canada's provincial premiers and territorial leaders was marked by the absence of several Indigenous leaders. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, they boycotted the event.
Native leaders are usually at such meetings, but not this time. Three major organizations representing tens of thousands of the country's Indigenous people were absent from the table. They included the Assembly of First Nations, the Tipiret Kanatami, and the Métis National Council. They stayed away to draw attention to what they say is their bid for a full and meaningful inclusion in the larger annual gathering of provincial and territorial leaders. Here's what Perry Bellegarde, the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, said about the boycott.
We're just basically trying to send a message to the different bureaucrats that help design these federal provincial tables, or in this case the Council of the Federation, to show more respect for the Indigenous governments of Canada, Indigenous nations. Throughout this past year, it's been demonstrated that they're trying to exclude or limit our participation in various federal provincial government tables, and we're saying that's just not acceptable in 2017.
Bellegarde says Canada's native people are not ethnic minorities, but Indigenous peoples with the right to self-determination because they have their own lands, laws, and languages. He says long-standing issues of this year come to a head, and unless native groups take a stand, no one will listen. The Premier from Alberta, Rachel Notley, said although the Native leaders were not at the meeting, she and the others are fully committed to engaging with them around a common table and to make progress on issues that are critically important to Indigenous people. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Basketball stars Shoni and Jude Schimmel are spending some of their summer inspiring Native young people and teaching them skills beyond the court. As Rhonda Lavaldo reports, the sisters held a basketball camp over the weekend on the Kickapoo Reservation in Kansas.
Over 100 children participated in the youth basketball camp put on by the Schimmel sisters, known for their time at Louisville and Shoni Schimmel's WNBA career. The Good Health and Wellness Connections director, Raphael Wawasik, says they always had a sizable group, but having the sisters there gave the event a boost in numbers.
I've worked with youth in Native communities for quite a number of years, and one of the things that I've always seen is there's tons of potential in a lot of kids in a lot of our communities. But the difference between having Shoni and Jude at an event like this is that it helps them to see what they can achieve for themselves personally. It helps to keep giving them some little drive, help make them want to work harder and do what they need to do to get to that next step.
Both sisters agreed that they want the kids to have a good time, but they also want to teach them to stay healthy. There was plenty of WNBA fans at the camp for Shoni Schimmel, who addressed her time off from the league.
So I just took this year off just to take a break, and I mean, I've been playing basketball since I was 4 and 25 now, so you know, it's been a few years, and so just being able to take a break, I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with that, and it's been great being able to come to these camps and, you know, different speaking engagements. I've been to a few powwows, and I'm still out there, still around, and I'm just, you know, playing basketball still, and so it's just one of those things where it's just like, I'll be there next year.
The sisters say they plan on doing more camps in the future. For National Native News, I'm Rhonda Lavaldo.
Native educators are gathering this week in Canada for the World Indigenous Peoples Conference on Education. Held every 3 years, the event focuses on finding ways to impact Indigenous education. Six Nations Polytechnic, an Indigenous institute for higher learning, is this year's host. The gathering is expected to draw thousands of people, with a majority from Canada, Australia, and the U.S. As Canada celebrates its 150th birthday, educators are taking a look at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was created to inform Canadians about Indian residential schools. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation. with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support from AmeriCorps Vista, whose members fight against poverty while earning money for college and gaining skills, with rewarding service opportunities around the country and info at AmeriCorps.gov/Vista. Support by BNSF Railway Company, supporting science, technology, and engineering careers through a partnership with the American Indian Science and Engineering Society. BNSF STEM scholarships available at AISES.org/scholarships.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And welcome to a Juno Afternoon. I'm this afternoon's volunteer host, Lori Scandling, and our producer, Jeff Brown, is here as well. Our first guest today is Daniel Fox. He is a photographer and a solo wilderness explorer who has traveled around the world taking pictures both of places and of people. And he has a very strong belief that nature has a purpose for humans in many ways. Welcome, Daniel. Good to see you again. We remembered that we chatted a couple of years ago.
Absolutely.
And that you had kayaked overnight, I think it was from Taku Inlet, and you had described seeing phosphorescence in the water as well as having orcas nearby as you paddled alone at night from there to Juneau. And I remember that sounding very magical. And I want to know how long you have been living the life of the explorer. I know you do more than explore, but talk about the root of your wanderlust.
It started about 9 years ago. I was living in New York City, and I had tried to make it in the corporate world for about 10 years. When I was young, I wanted to travel to sail the oceans and study whales, and somehow I ended up being asked to go into business school, and at one point in your life, you have to be serious and consider the responsibilities, and I try to make it. And after 10 years of going that route, I got to a point where I needed to reassess my priorities and how I wanted my next 10 years to look like, and it was not what I had at that moment. So I sold everything, and I went to Argentina, where I reconnected with myself, with my purpose, and started the Wild Image Project, which for me is my narrative of exploration. It's this personal reconnection with life and using nature as a framework and mindset for personal transformation. I've always believed that nature is something that is bigger than you. It's a mentor. It's a way to understand life. Unfortunately, in our industrial modern culture, we've put ourselves above nature and we've lost the connection to something that is much bigger and something that is sacred. So I'm trying to bring back this certain sense of look at life. Understanding that life is not meant to be fair, is not meant to be perfect. The high is only relative to the lows. The lows are there for to grow. If life was perfect already, there would be no room for growth. And there's always a growing pains every time that you grow. And that's part of that discovery. And we need to culturally start to embrace that again, as opposed to try to sanitize and shy away from it.
What are the ways in which people can reconnect with nature in order to take control of their lives, which is a connection that you try to make? What are the actual things people can do? I think of real-life challenges that those who are barely making ends meet, maybe raising some children on their own, perhaps living in many other parts of the world where not working and getting away from maybe centers of population would be very challenging.
Well, first of all, we have to remind ourselves that the human species is not separated from nature. We are a product of it. It's impossible to think that we can live on this planet separated from the animals or from our environment. In fact, we're a product of it. We're connected with it. And I think that this type of philosophy goes back a little bit more with the natives or the First Nations. the indigenous communities, where they saw themselves as part of a web of relationships and a network of connections. So understanding that our presence on this planet is not to save the planet, but to learn to live in a reciprocity with it. When we try to put ourselves above it, it puts a tremendous sense of a burden of responsibility, and people start to feel guilty, anxious, with a lot of anxiety, as opposed to seeing themselves as part of a community, part of this, all these relationships that we're connected with, and nature being one of them. And it's honoring this relationship as opposed to trying to save it. That relationship with nature is not common in our culture, because we think we're the stewards, we're the protector, we're the ones that have the responsibility of saving the animals, saving the ocean, saving all this, when in reality we all have different priorities, putting food on the table, sending our children to school, making sure that our relationship or marriage work, all these are priorities. We can talk about garbage in the ocean, but in reality it comes lower in that ladder of priorities.
Part of your work is to facilitate individuals who want to make that reconnection with themselves through the world. What does that look like?
It's always interesting because I often say that I love to work with people that I have suffered or have had challenges, because when you're young, you think that the world is black and white, and you go out and you have this really black and white way of looking at the world. When you start to live through some deceptions, through some struggles, and you've lost some of the things that were important to you, and some people find themselves in the need of fixing or trying to find a way to get out of there. They've often hit the rock bottom, which forces them to look at things in a different way. And I will take their journey and we'll compare it to something in nature, climbing a mountain, going on a kayak expeditions, looking at how a forest evolves, looking at all these things that are around us that are natural, and they're close to our own journey, understanding that everything in life is about perspective. There's nothing really wrong or right. It just depends how you look at things. So when people have troubles, it's often just a question of perspective. They're looking at it from a position in where they feel powerless. But if you're able to just slightly move that angle, just that nudge that changes the boat, it might seem little at the beginning, but down the line, it's miles and miles and miles apart from where they were originally going.
In working with individuals and this reconnection to nature, for example, do you lead expeditions? Do you go on trips with people, or do you instruct them on how to survive in nature, for example? What is your role in making that connection?
So I have two. Wilderness for me is my studio. It's where I go to create. Like a painter goes into his studio and find that solitude, wilderness is that for me. I will go on my solo wilderness trips to purposely create something, a story that is there for me to catch, to seek photos to do. So that is my own personal creative process. And then after that, with other people, I lead expeditions, I will take them out. Mainly what I try to do is I create a space for them to see something new. I've understood a long time ago that you cannot force people to do something that they're not ready. I always say, you know, it says on packs of cigarettes will kill you, people still smoke. So I try to set the table, put the food, create an atmosphere, set the music on, and invite them to switch their, you know, move their chair a little bit so that they can see all that with a different eye, with a different perspective. I try to plant that seed, but I'm not responsible for them to make sure that they nurture that seed or that they have to take that initial desire on that path. But my role is to create that space for them.
About how many days a year would you say you are in motion traveling? And do you have a home base?
I do now. Well, I'm married, so it's I'm married the most amazing person, and it has changed a little bit, but now we're trying to be on the road together. I would say that about a third of my year. And then after that, I bring those stories to the public. So there's going to be a different kind of writing. But I love the road. It took me a while to come to terms with my desire to be on the road, because I think that you go through a phase of asking, am I escaping something? Am I fleeing? Am I afraid of commitment? But the truth is that I love the energy of being on the road. I love these random connections. I love all the things that comes with it. These unexpected discoveries. I remember listening to Eric Schmidt from Google, and he was talking about Google Map, and he was saying, imagine a world where, like, no one would ever get lost. And I cringed. I just went, like, no, this is not what life or the world is about. You want to get lost. You want to know where you're going, but at the same time, you want it left the unexpected to happen, because this is where the magic happens. And Alaska for me has been part of that discovery. I have, you know, an adopted family on Kodiak. I have an adopted family here in Juneau. I've just lost a friend here in Juneau a couple months ago. But I have all these people, like my family is spread in all these different places. Because independently of the wilderness or these remote places I've been, I think that the most precious that I have is the people that I've met along the way.
Where was the first place that you headed off to when you broke away from the corporate life in New York City? And how old are you now?
I'm 42 years old.
So that was how long ago?
At the end of 35, I think, 33, 4, losing track of time.
So you've been exploring, and we should mention you're a fine photographer. This helps support your goal of exploring as much as you can. Where was your first stop?
Argentina.
You did say,
yeah.
Argentina.
I was in a really desperate place in my life. I literally put my finger on the map. I was living in New York City, and I trailed down the map, and I went as far south as I could, and basically it was Argentina, and that's when I went, and that's where I ended up spending 6 months at Valdez Peninsula, this place where the orcas are known to beach themselves. And it's truly that place that offered me. It's funny, because Argentina has been down for many people. If you think of Darwin, that's where all his concept of evolution came together. If you think of Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, the famous French aviator and writer, this is like Argentina was his muse. Chatwin, Thoreau, big writers. Like, Argentina has been this place where they go to reconnect with something. And it was the same for me. It was my a rebirth.
So tell me how an explorer makes money. I see that you are...
They don't.
Well, I see that you are an ambassador, for example,
yes.
For Wilderness Systems, which is a kayak-making company,
yeah.
And a number of other companies, such as Fujifilm and some others. Is that how you support yourself primarily?
I support primarily with my photos. My prints are exclusive and high. They command good money. I print them more like photo, like paintings, meaning that there's going to be one, and it's printed only for a client, and it's never get printed again. So there will never be another one.
So it is a work of art.
Yeah, there's a work of art. There's a story behind it. If I work with a hotel, I will specifically do an expedition for that. And so there's a story that's behind it, and they feel that they're buying more than just a print, but they're buying the story behind, so that the client can look at the photo on the wall and see something more. When I photograph mainly two types of things. One is wildlife portraits. I call them totems. I never hide from the animals. I want them to see me. My motto is I don't want it to receive the shot. I don't want to take the shot. It's a more of a exchange between them and me. And people have said that there's an intimacy in my photos, and it's true. That's what I try to capture. I try to capture this bond between two species who find themselves in the same spot, sharing the same air. And I don't see, in that moment, I don't see them as wild animals and me, but just two creatures in that location. So I don't hide from them. I want to capture their eyes. I want to capture their energy, their spirit. I don't want to humanize or beautify them, but I want to honor each their spirit of survival, who they are as a creature of this planet. And then the other one that I do with nature is often I create abstract. I want to take the context out and create something that is familiar without exactly knowing what it is. So the exchange between the viewer and the photo is a little bit more dynamic. Like you will recognize what it is without even not knowing. So you start asking yourself questions. You start, wait, what is this? And then you make yourself your own little story, your own little interpretation, as opposed to just giving you something that is obvious.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Daniel Fox. He is a solo wilderness explorer and a photographer. Speaking of, you mentioned the term random connections, and in connection with your photography, you're doing a project right now that is a unique concept. Can you please describe it and how you arrived at this idea?
Well, I've always come to Juneau to Alaska for the wilderness, for the remote places. And this time I wanted to come back with a different purpose. And some time ago, I thought of this photo project that would connect me more with the people as opposed to the animals. And Random Connectedness is a photo project that wants to illustrate the random connectivity of our species. So I've done all the... I've taken the entire alphabet and cut out the letters. So I have all the letters, the characters of the alphabet. And then I go and ask people to choose a letter that they want to be photographed with. And then I take a portrait of that.
Just one letter?
Two letters, actually, because it increases the choices that I can do. And then after that, I combine those letters and to create campaigns or words. So I have one campaign. It's Stop, Breathe, Relax, Listen. It's one of my mantras. I have one, it's the power of nature, feel the wild. So ultimately, down the line, once I'm going to have thousands of different characters, I want to create this huge mural of like the manifesto of humanity, something like that, and each being a character of a person somewhere on this planet.
So I might have my picture taken holding one or two red letters.
I hope so.
And I wouldn't know where that letter might show up in a combination of words that
I do keep emails of people, and I let them know that it's not going to go up unless I have their approval or their, so they're involved in that journey.
But I might be part of a word that would involve, say, five other people from around the world holding the words, or pardon me, the letters that might contribute to the word listen.
Absolutely.
Now, you mentioned that you chose to make the letters red for a very specific reason. What is
that? So everything that I do always have different meanings. They're not there just for the fun of it. I'm a big lover of the Eastern philosophies.
I notice your tattoos
all my tattoos are Japanese. But in this particular case, the letters are red. Because it ties into the Chinese myth of the red string of fate, which, according to their mythology, the gods have tied this invisible red thread at the ankles of all the people who are supposed to help each other or marry each other. So these letters are red to illustrate that string of fate that connects us all.
Talk a little bit about your Project Wild, that's a WILD, which is an initiative that you've worked on. What is that intention?
I was paddling actually in Alaska when that with the idea came to me, because I do my work. I'm an artist. I do my work by myself. I felt that my connection to children was missing, and I'm the great uncle, but I don't have the patience to just go out and like I like to come and just do and play with them, and then I leave. So I was trying to find a project that would allow me to do that, and my strength were to raise awareness, raise money, funds, and do campaigns. So what could I do to put all that together? And WILD is my cause, Wilderness Immersion for Leadership and Discovery. And I raise money to send inner-city youth or underprivileged teens to a month-long wilderness immersion camp with NOLS, so National Outdoor Leadership School. And the first one that I did a big paddle, and I sent two teens to Alaska to a sea hiking month-long. And Caden, one of my scholarship recipients, has been a joy to... I stay with them. I mentor them. I use my sponsors to gear them up, because I think the most challenging thing for them, once they receive a gift, is to continue after that, it's the support network. It can even be even more frustrating when they go back home and they've been exposed to something else, how they don't have that support, and it can actually totally backfire. So for me, it's really important to focus on the quality and the small amount, as opposed to just, you know, send as many kids and not be there for them. So I'm always present. They can reach me at any time of the, and I will use my own network, my connections, my sponsors to make sure that they are next to me as I do my own journey.
Where haven't you been in the world that you'd like to go?
Japan. As crazy as it might sound, I've never been to Japan. I've always felt that I have a love story with it. For me, there's a lot of that culture that resonates with me. Maybe because of the Shinto is something that is makes sense. Their idea that life is more about finding a balance as opposed to trying to separate things. I mean, even if you start from the yin and the yang, you know, the visual of it, and even the white has a little bit of black and vice versa. But like all the things that we see as a problem, they see as a beauty. Like time has a beauty, imperfection has a beauty. You look at a Japanese garden, and even though the trees are sculpted, the moss is there to break that perfectness, and it's there for a reason. And I love the food. Everything is there for a reason. You know, you take sushi, the wasabi is there for a reason, the ginger is there for a reason. And you cannot just have raw fish. You want to balance it with the rice. And it's just this way of looking at the world that is more in harmony. And they believe, Shinto believes that everything has a spirit, an energy. And I love to look at the world in that perspective. It makes you appreciate and makes you respect it more, as opposed to just think that everything around you is not alive.
We're talking with Daniel Fox. He is a solo wilderness explorer and photographer, and he founded WILD, which is Wilderness Immersion for Leadership and Discovery. And he has a photo project going on right now. If someone would like to connect with you and what you do, what is the best way for them to do that, Daniel?
They can look on my website, www.danielfox.co, not C-O-M, but C-O. There's a contact page. They can find me on Facebook, Instagram. And right now I'm in Juneau until the 30th, and I'm taking pictures of people that live and work in Juneau. And I want to create these campaigns of these sentences of, I love Juneau, I am Juneau, the spirit of Juneau. So far I've been working with Travel Juneau, with Kara Travel Juneau, and we've been going around town, and just earlier this afternoon I was at Tracy's King Crab Shack, and I photographed the entire staff, and we're going to be spelling out Tracy's King Crab Shack. Over the weekend we were in Angoon at Favorite Bay Lodge, so I photographed the entire staff over there, and we're going to were spelling out Favorite and Bay Lodge. And so there's so much story, so many stories here in Juneau of people who came to Alaska never with the intent to stay, and then they're like, oh yeah, you know, I came here just for some this and that, and then I'm here 40 years later. And it's just this, and one of the things that is the most surprising, and I'm so happy to see that, is you see these kids now that could easily say goodbye, you know, this is too, I want to go to California, I want to go to New York, I want to go where the action is. And they go and they come back. I met with that couple who started this kelp, Leah, I think, and her her husband.
And Matt Kern.
Yeah, the kelp, and then the distillery downtown.
Mm-hmm. Brandon Howard.
Absolutely, Dave from Dave Deckhand. All these fascinating young entrepreneurs who are just filled with energy and a desire to make, you know, to stay in Juneau and to promote it and in a way that is sustainable and imaginative, and I love it.
It's inspiring, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I find it so as well. Daniel, thank you for joining me today. It's great to have you with us again. If you'd like to know more about Daniel Fox, you can find him online at www.danielfox.co.
Always a pleasure.
Good to see you. Thanks for staying with us on a Juneau afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling, this afternoon's volunteer. My next guest is Charles Ward. He is the worshipful master, I just had to say that, of the Masonic Center here in Juneau. And, of course, I have to ask, worshipful master, what does that mean? It sounds a little archaic.
It is. It is actually a little bit archaic. We do like our titles in the Masonic community. It stems from a time when the word worshipful didn't necessarily mean someone you pray to. It meant someone that was worthy of respect, and so something like that. So instead of calling me the president of the lodge this year, they call me the worshipful master, and the vice presidents are the senior and junior warden, and we have other officers as well. It goes down the line.
But Masons are a very old organization, right?
Yes. Organized Masonry is actually, under what's called the Grand Lodge system, is actually celebrating its 300th anniversary this year. Starting with the formation of the Grand Lodge in England back in 1717. But Masonry as a fraternity and a fraternal organization goes back even further than that. Started with, the best guess is it started in about the 1600s Scotland, actually, and then kind of moved to England as a guild. It was basically a trade union for
Masons.
Yeah, what we call operative Masons,
sure.
People that built things. And at that time, you know, you would go to a town and you would build the cathedral or the castle or whatever the high-ranking person there needed built. And then a few guys would stay around to maintain it and make sure everything was built and build some smaller stuff. But the main group needed to go on to the next town because there was another baron or priest or something that needed a castle or a cathedral built or something like that. So they would travel from place to place. And the way you would know that these Masons were actually part of the guild was they would have these passwords and they would have these funny grips and things like that. And so we don't do a lot of building anymore, except we just built our new building, but we kept the passwords and the grips and those sorts of things.
What is the mission of the Masons in today's world?
Well, in today's world, we have a kind of the marketing phrase, I guess, is take good men and make them better. So the idea is to take people that have a core sense of good values and have a good sense of good character and try to help them build upon that and become better people, better men, better husbands, better fathers, better sons, better brothers, those sorts of things.
So it's for men only?
The Masonic Lodge is a men's organization. We do have a what's called a concordant body, which is the Eastern Star, which is co-ed. The Masonic Lodge itself is a fraternal organization.
And we talk about values and character. Does that mean Christian-based, or has that a broader meaning?
No, so it's not. Masonry is not Christian, and it's not intended to be a substitute for a religion. To be a member, you are asked if you place your belief in a supreme being, but that's as far as the inquiry goes. So if you can answer honestly that you place your belief in a supreme being, as far as religion is concerned, that's as far as the inquiry goes. We do have some traditions and rituals and things like that that will refer to different volumes of what we call volumes of sacred law, so the Bible, the Quran. We even have some from other faith traditions as well. Get referred to, but it's not required that you believe in them, except to understand that you can take things from all religious ideas and kind of understand there's a commonality of, the golden rule is not unique to Christianity. It is all over in all kind of faith traditions, and there's several examples of things that if you're a Christian, you may have learned this rule this way, but if you're a Buddhist, you may have learned it this rule this way, and if you're a Muslim, you may have learned this rule this way, and so going on from that, and don't really even necessarily have to have a religious tradition necessarily, just a faith tradition, I guess.
What drew you to Masonry?
So I was in a fraternity in college, and way back when, and I enjoyed the brotherhood and the camaraderie aspect of that element, and moved around from place to place after college in the journalism world, as sometimes happens, and but I always had in the back of my mind that I was going to explore the Masonic Lodge and explore that sense of fraternity and that sense of brotherhood there. And got to Juneau and was able to put some roots down and decided that was where I was going to begin my exploration. And so that's where I kind of got started learning about Masonry and then eventually joining the Lodge and some of the other appendant organizations here in Juneau.
And how do the Masons make a man a better man?
Well, like I said, we try to reinforce the values of being a good person and how giving you building blocks, for lack of a better word, and tools to use to become a better man and a better person. One thing we will talk about, for example, when you see a Mason, the first thing you may notice about him, if he's ready for a meeting, he'll be wearing an apron. Masonic apron, and the apron is considered, it's the first thing you get when you become a Mason, when you go through the first ritual process, and the apron is something we give to somebody and use it as a symbol, say this is a pure and spotless surface, because it's a white leather or leather type surface apron, and that you're supposed to live your life and hold that pure and spotless surface and live your life. The ideal of your life, anyway, is to have it be as pure and spotless as the surface of that apron, so that you can live, you can wear that apron with pride to yourself and the fraternity because you are living a life of good conduct and good morals. None of us ever achieve perfection, so it's always, you're constantly trying to build and improve yourself, but you never, that's what you're taught to strive towards, and there's hundreds of examples of symbols, and we're kind of famous for having some symbols that a few of them we've come up with ourselves, a lot of them we've borrowed from other traditions and things like that, and they all have meanings along those lines.
Does it also involve, say, training or shared reading, recommended reading, discussion groups?
So, yeah, there are some when you go through the, what are called the degrees, when you're going through the Masonic Lodge, there's 3 degrees, your first degree, second degree, third degree. In fact, you may have heard someone's ever heard, you've heard them say, I got the third degree that day, or, boy, they were really giving me the third degree. Lori really gave me the third degree when she interviewed me. That's where that comes from, is from the third degree. So there's kind of a call and response you go through when you'll be assigned. You get assigned a coach, and the coach asks you these ritual questions, and you provide ritual answers, and you have to memorize it. And as you memorize it, you start to learn some of the lessons, or the hope is you start to learn some of the lessons that are taught in those degrees.
We are talking with Charles Ward. He has on a shirt that says WM2017, so that helps me remember. Truly, Worshipful yeah. Master. And you have on, I see the Masonic insignia on the side of right. the shirt. So we talked briefly a few minutes ago about Worshipful Master being really a term of respect. Let's talk about this idea that the Masons are going to carry out during this next month as part of the Juneau Police Department's initiative, doing a year of kindness.
Correct.
It is about having a civil cup of coffee with each other. And I read about this some weeks ago, and I thought, how grateful I was that someone would want to make a space where civility is valued in the discussion of even the most sensitive topics. And on the other hand, I thought, oh my gosh, we have to clear the decks to do that now. How ironic, at a time when really we should be enjoying the greatest freedom probably ever in our country. So right. Describe how the Masons came up with this idea and what you're hoping to achieve.
Well, one thing, Masonry, there's no, believe it or not, for the Masonic Lodge, now we have certain what are called appendant concordant bodies, like I mentioned, the Eastern Star. A lot of people know this, but the Shrine, all Shriners are Masons, and they're considered a concordant body. We have the Scottish Rite, and here in town we also have the Rainbow Girls and DMLA, which are youth organizations. But anyway, for the Masonic Lodge itself, there's no national governing body. It's all run at the state level. So, and then again at the local level. But there are some national groups that kind of get together, for lack of a better word, kind of think tanks where they come up with ideas and try to raise to improve Masonry, but also to make them more relevant toward today's age and what's going on in society. And so one of those organizations is, or one of those thoughts is civility, trying to either reintroduce or improve civility into our world, because I think regardless of where you stand on any issue, it's kind of gotten to a point where a lot of times you can't have discussions with people about anything, because especially if you're online, because it just becomes, you go down this list very rapidly, very quickly, and all everybody brings up is the parade of horribles, the worst possible way that your viewpoint can be expressed, very often in profane language as well. It's tied to politics, but I've seen it tied to everything. What team you root for, and what city you live in, and what state you live in, and what church you go to, and things like that. And it used to be, we always have a way of romanticizing things in our heads, but it does seem to me that it used to be that you could have discussions with most reasonable people. Maybe you wouldn't persuade them, they wouldn't persuade you, but at least at the end of the day, you'd say, okay, well, I've heard what you've had to say, you've heard what I've had to say, and we're going to go on about our lives. Now I understand a little bit more about where you're coming from. It's become increasingly tough to do that these days, and you can see study after study or article after article about how polarized we are as a country, but it's not just, again, not just political polarization, it's rural versus urban, it's where you live, what religion did you believe in, all these things, and there's less and less of a common ground. So the Masonic Civility Project is trying to rein some of that back in, and not trying to persuade people politically, not trying to persuade people religiously or any other way, but just persuade them that when you have those discussions or discussions about anything else, that you do it in a civil manner and you do it respectfully and try to listen to what the other person has to say, because maybe you might learn something, and even if you don't, you would understand at least where the other person is coming from. So as broad scope, that's where our civility push and civility initiative is coming from. And it seemed to us that one way, you know, it used to be that people would get together and sit around and drink coffee, and that was kind of how you met each other and you talked to each other. And a lot of the people that we were in your coffee group, you know, you'd see the guys sitting around at the shop or wherever drinking coffee, and a lot of those guys had differences. A lot of those guys were Democrats versus Republicans. A lot of those guys went to different churches and things like that. But they all managed to get together on Saturday morning and have coffee. So that's what we're going to try to bring back, is the idea of having just a cup of coffee where you sit and have civil, polite discussion.
And you mentioned guys, but it sounds like a civil cup of coffee, which will start this Saturday at 8 in the morning. Is that open to everybody?
Oh, that's absolutely open to everybody. Okay. Yeah, sorry. That's a good catch on your part. It is open to everybody. Anybody is welcome to come.
And the Masonic Center is at 9315 Glacier Highway.
Correct.
And can folks just show up and coffee will be there? And do they just join a table?
Yeah, essentially that's it. Coffee will be there. Hopefully we won't run out. I think we've ordered enough, but you never know.
People might be uncivil if you do.
Yeah, that's true.
Caffeine's kind of a driving force for some of us.
We do have our own coffee maker, but we've ordered some special from Heritage, too, so that we'll have enough. But worst comes to worst, we'll have that. And we'll also have some tea from Northern Tea Company.
Mm-hmm. And will you be doing this on other Saturdays as well as this coming Saturday?
We've talked about it. We're going to see how this goes. And see, you know, what kind of turnout we get and whether we get the kind of response, both civilly and things like that, that they're hoping to get. And if it does turn out, then, yeah, maybe we will make it a regular feature of something we do. But we don't have any plans for a follow-up as of yet, but I know we've talked about possibly following up with it.
Well, thank you, Charles. We're talking with Charles Ward. He is a leader in the Masonic Lodge here in Juneau. If you're interested in participating in a civil cup of coffee and having a civil conversation with others, join them 8 o'clock Saturday morning, July 29th at the Juneau Masonic Center, and that is at 9315 Glacier Highway. And thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me in. I very much appreciate it.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 24th of July, 2017. It's the birthday of Alexandre Dumas, born in Villers, Carteret, France, 1802, who wrote swashbuckling adventure novels like The Three Musketeers, The Count of Monte Cristo, which were serialized in newspapers to generate new subscriptions. It's the birthday of the poet, novelist Robert Graves, born Wimbledon, 1895. Robert Graves, who said, "Poetry is practical, a practical, humorous, reasonable way of being ourselves, of never acquiescing in a fraud, of never accepting the second rate in poetry, painting, music, love, friendships." It's the birthday of Amelia Earhart, born Atchison, Kansas, 1897. She became a pilot. She was the first person to fly from California to Hawaii. She was attractive. She was well-spoken, so the aviation industry used her as a symbol to reassure women that flying was safe. But unfortunately, on her second attempt to fly around the globe, she disappeared at the Central Pacific, somewhere near the international dateline. It's the birthday of Zelda Fitzgerald, born Zelda Sayre, Montgomery, Alabama, 1900. She met F. Scott Fitzgerald at a military dance when he was stationed in Montgomery. Zelda said he smelled like new goods. And they went on their first date on this day, her birthday, 1918. Years later, in a letter, she wrote, "The night you gave me my birthday party, you were a young lieutenant and I was a fragrant phantom, and it was a radiant night, a night of soft conspiracy, and the trees agreed that it was all going to be for the best." And it was on this day, 1847, that Brigham Young led his Mormon people into the valley of the Great Salt Lake. He had gotten sick on the journey. He was being carried, lying prostrate in a wagon, but when they got to the edge of the mountain, the wagon stopped, and according to legend, Brigham Young was able to describe the scene below without looking, and then he sat up and looked and said, "This is the right place. Drive on." Here's a poem for today by Faith Sheeran, Directions to Your College Dorm. All hallways still lead to that room with its ceiling so high it might have been a sky, and your metal bed by the window, and your crate of books. First, you must walk across the deep winter campus to find your friend throwing snowballs that float for years. Then open our letters, shelves of words. You will find our coats, our awkwardness, the tickets from the trains that witnessed our confusion. Love was the place where we became as naked as morning. It was dangerous and dappled, and we visited its shores with suitcases and maps from childhood. I remember our shadows growing on your wall while a candle swallowed itself. You kept a single glass of water on a desk, and it trembled whenever we danced. A poem by Faith Sheeran, Directions to Your College Dorm, from Orpheus Turning, published by the Broadkill River Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Progressive Insurance with the Name Your Price tool, offering a range of coverage and price options to choose from. Now that's Progressive. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, offering artisan coffees, fresh baked goods, salads, sandwiches, and more at their downtown and Glacier cafes. More information at heritagecoffee.com.
This is Bird Note. Some birds are wonderfully graceful in flight. Swallows spring to mind with their deft swoops and glides. But there's a bird of prey in the American Southeast that takes grace to an utterly new level. The swallow-tailed kite. A swallow-tailed kite, even perched, is a lovely bird. It's a slim, sleek raptor with a pure white head and underside, offset by exceptionally long, slender black wings. True to its name, it sports a long, deeply forked black tail. A swallow-tailed kite in flight almost never flaps its wings. Instead, the kite uses its tail to pivot and twist to guide its movements. The bird can make sudden, tight turns, upside-down moves, and quick backward dives. Its aerial maneuvers hardly seem like flight at all, more like slipping and sliding across the air. Kites catch all their prey on the wing, snatching large flying insects out of the air and taking lizards and snakes off leaves in the trees with their talons. Then, in a magician-quick motion, the kite transfers its prey from its talons to its hooked beak. Spring or summer is the time to see swallow-tailed kites in the Southeast. Then, they're off to South America, covering hundreds or thousands of miles, all with hardly a flap of the wing. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Forty years ago, the first barrel of oil flowed down the Trans-Alaska pipeline.
All of a sudden, in the middle of the night, it goes, shh, and I just woke up and I went, oil's in.
Midnight Oil is a new series and podcast from Alaska's Energy Desk about the pipeline that shaped the state. Visit ktoo.org or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Stacia Harris from the Year of Kindness Steering Committee. As part of 17YOK, all sorts of groups are adopting specific weeks during which they do something to help spread kindness. This week's group is the Mount Juneau Gastineau Lodge. You can sign up for a week by emailing 17YOK at junopolice.com. Together we can make Juneau a better place to live.
So glad you could join us this afternoon on a Juneau afternoon. Looking ahead to tomorrow, I'll be here and we'll talk with Rachel Jusler about her upcoming class in slumped glass techniques, and Alexandra Pierce will be on the air to highlight the planned dog park. And of course, there's bird note, music, writer's almanac, and more. Looking at the weather, rainy and cloudy. Rest of today, patchy fog. Tonight, cloudy in the mid-50s. Tomorrow, cloudy, highs around 60. Tuesday night, again, a chance of rain with lows around 50. And into Wednesday, continues that chance of rain showers with highs around 60. Thanks to Jeff Brown for producing our show, and thanks to you for joining us on a Juneau afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling. Tonight at 7 on Focus on Community, there will be a broadcast of author David Ramser's talk about Melting the Ice Curtain, recorded last Tuesday night during the Juneau World Affairs Council presentation right here in KTOO Studios. Tune in for that at 7 this evening.